Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives. A powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett. Up next, my unedited conversation with explorer and linguist of landscape, Robert McFarlane. There is a shorter produced version of this wherever you found this podcast. Were you just doing another interview?
Yes, I was with Michael Enright up at CBC, who I'd met before actually here in Cambridge, but we had a great conversation. So my voice is well warmed up.
Okay, good. I'm glad you feel that way rather than talked out.
No, not at all. I'm buzzed.
Chris, how are we? Do we need more? Do we need levels or anything? Maybe not. Okay. Okay. So I may say this again in the course of the interview, but you know, I've been reading you for years, and I've read I tend to read you when I'm actually kind of resting or on vacation or traveling, when I can kind of sink into the writing more than I can even, you know, even in preparing for a conversation like this. So I've read all or part of, I think, most of your books. Wow. And anyway, it's just so wonderful to be speaking.
That's lovely to hear.
Yeah. So let's just plunge in. You know, there's this sentence you have, for nearly two decades, I have been writing about the relationships of landscape and the human heart. And I just find that such an intriguing way for you to describe your focus and that intersection. And I wonder, you know, how would you trace the earliest, deepest roots of this? And then, even as I wrote that question, I realized that's kind of an underland metaphor. but like the deepest roots of this orientation in your earliest life, in the background of your life and childhood.
That is a searching question and a very good one for it. And I think whenever we find a route and follow it back, we'll think we've reached its end and it will branch off again and surprise us. But I guess if I were to follow the first route back, it would take me into the mountains that I didn't live in, but I did in a sense grow up in. And those were the mountains of the Cairngorms in the northeast of Scotland, where my grandparents lived for many decades. And that's really where I walked into landscape for the first time. And I have some pristinated memories from those places where everything else from those years, those early years, is a mist. I can't remember anything from my Nottinghamshire childhood, but I can remember picking up a roe deer's antler that was as exotic as coral to me from the side of a Highland river. So I think that the power of that place, those Arctic mountains of Britain, they grooved deep into me.
And those, you know, those mountains, those Arctic mountains of Britain, as you say, are not really what people think of when they think of Britain. Wasn't your grandfather also, he was a mountain climber involved in planning those historic Everest expeditions in the 20th century?
Yes, he was.
It was that same grandfather?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. He had 6 foot long ice axe, more or less. That was a sort of superhero's weapon that let him levitate. But he as a young man in Switzerland, he stood on his first alpine summit and met General Bruce, who was one of the sort of military toffs who led the early Everest expeditions 21, 22, and 24. And that thrilled him, as they say, to a life of the mountains. And in the 50s, he was involved in planning around big Himalayan expeditions from an administrative point of view. But yeah, he climbed, skied, and walked all over the world.
And I also was intrigued to see somewhere a mention that your father, that you grew up in coal mining country and that your father was a lung doctor. And that, you know, that juxtaposition also seemed to me to be at that point between landscape and the human heart.
I hadn't thought of it like that. But you're right. It was a way that I began to look inside people, as it were. He would bring these x-rays home of people's lungs, confidentially, obviously, not disclosing anything, but he would hold them up against the window as a light box. And we would, my brother and I would see into this huge space of the human lung. And he would show us the spotting that showed, you know, black lung or silicosis. And he would just talk about what had happened to the people who were working almost under our feet. And the happiest person I knew when I was growing up was a coal miner who was no longer a coal miner. And he taught me how to whistle.
Right.
Because he loved being in the sun.
So, as I said to you before we began this, the official interview, I have been reading you for years and kind of the sweep of your writing and exploring. And I was really kind of agonized about how do I turn all of that into a conversation. So I decided that I really want to focus on Underland, which is your newest book. And also I think a book that people are discovering in this country in a big way, which has been exciting to see. But use that as kind of a focal point to also more expansively explore how your thinking and accumulated way of seeing the world and experiencing it rolls around inside you. And I feel like that also does find expression in the writing of Underland. So, and it's so interesting to see how, I think you said it this way in another interview, that your body of work, the gradient of your body of work has been tending downwards because you began writing about mountains.
Yeah.
Mountains of the mind, and then there were the valleys and moors in wild places, and then there's traversing the world on foot in the old ways, and now you have gone down to the worlds beneath our feet. And you said, we know so little of the worlds beneath our feet. And I think just naming that, not something that we even think about, how little we know of the worlds beneath our feet.
They are dark places in several senses. That's I sometimes say to my children, we walk on this thin crust above this raging space of life and matter in all its vibrancy and fury, and we know nothing of it. Our sight stops at our toes. It stops at ground level, and sight is so bound up with modern ways of knowing. We can, I say early in Underland, we can look up and see literally trillions of miles. We can see light coming from stars across the universe, across the galaxy. But we look down and we can't see beyond the grass or the tarmac.
Yeah. And you went to such an unexpected array of places, right? Beneath that thin surface beyond which we can't see. I mean, it was really stunning. I don't know exactly what I expected when I opened the book, but you know, I think I expected the roots of trees, right? I didn't expect caves and a dark matter laboratory below the ground in Yorkshire and this subterranean alternative universe in beneath Paris and right, and burial chambers in Finland for high-level nuclear waste. And I'm just really curious, when you started this adventure, were all those places on your map?
They were not. The only thing I knew is that the book would be a descent at its beginning, and it would be a surfacing at its ending. And that is because that is the oldest story we have ever really told about ourselves. The Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest story of which we have written record, is in one of its variants a descent to the underworld and the return with knowledge of children who have died and who were not seen, but the emissary to the underworld gets to glimpse them and report back to the grieving parent. And that story is there in, as you know, in Greek myth, over and over again, usually with really incompetent men involved screwing up the scenario. Orpheus goes down to get Eurydice safely back and then goofs it up because he can't control himself. Well, where have we heard that before? And Creon walls up Antigone to silence her. So, but that descent, and then the harder thing is surfacing again. So I knew it. I wanted it to have that form, but beyond that, I had no idea where I would end up.
Yeah, that's so interesting to think about. Also, the there's an echo. I mean, obviously, it's what you're describing is it's another way to talk about how we know so little of the world beneath our feet. But that idea that we go down and we see and in some sense recover what we believed to be lost.
That's a lovely way of putting it, what we believed to be lost. And I think I say very early on, and it took me a long time, many years really, to work this out, that there are three great tasks that the underland performs across cultures and millennia really, and these are to yield, to dispose, and to shelter. So it yields ore, resource in a very material way, but also metaphor and vision. It disposes of the bad stuff, the bodies that we want to get rid of in brutal contexts, the nuclear waste that we want to make the surface world safe from. But to return to your idea of the precious, it's where we put things that we care for most or value most. And that's often the dead.
Right. And then I couldn't help it. You know, all the way through all your adventures, there's also this existential and elemental echo to the physical act of going downwards and into the dark, right? And you know, you say it, you know, that since before we were Homo sapiens, humans have been seeking out spaces of darkness in which to find and make meaning, and that there's something seemingly paradoxical that darkness might be a medium of vision and that descent may be a movement towards revelation. And as you describe all of your adventures also, you also, even though that is true, that there's something strangely life-giving about that descent, but you over and over again not just thought about but experienced how counterintuitive it is to make that downwards move.
Yeah, your mind is screaming at you not to enter this space because it perceives it as a place of confinement and deprivation. And indeed, for many people, that's what the underland has been, prisoners and forced laborers. But it has also been a place of discovery and of revelation. And my first love is mountains, and the first book I ever wrote tried to understand why we're drawn upwards, often at risk of our own lives. But early on in working on this book, I began to realize how young that impulse is within a Western and modern imagination. It's only 300 years old. It's a punk. It's a stripling. And yet we see, obviously, this May on Everest, 200 plus people queuing at 8,800 meters to get their summit selfie. It's a powerful one, but it is a young one, unlike the urge to go into darkness and downwards.
Right. That the same qualities of mountains, which were once shunned and reviled by humanity, their steepness and desolation and perilousness, now are these prized experiences.
Yeah, I mean, that story is one of an astonishing revolution of perception, as I've called it. And you look back to the 17th century, and it's not absolute, but broadly speaking, there is no fetish of the summit. There is no summit fever. And wow, I've felt that fever burning in me at times, and it's still there. But you go back 65,000 years in Western Europe and you find Neanderthal artists going into cave spaces hard to reach cave spaces to make art on the limestone walls of those caves. Wow. I mean, that sends a shiver down my spine across time.
I'm feeling like for somebody who's listening and hasn't read the book, I would love for them to just hear a little bit of, like, you know, a little bit about one of the places you went. And I wouldn't choose. I mean, maybe you could talk about going into caves because somehow that was like just so incredible. And also when I first started reading you, and I actually was looking for it again and I couldn't find it, I remember reading in one of your books about how you climb trees. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't writing about climbing trees. It just was a feature of what you do. And so it became part of the narrative. And I felt so, well, a little bit envious, but also just so, I found that so thrilling to think that that is something that an adult can still do. But also I feel like you took that same freedom with your body and that same sense of, like curiosity, when you squeeze your body through impossible spaces. I mean, I don't know, what's a story that you like to tell about this underland journey if you have to choose one?
I mean, I'd love to tell you a story. I could just read you the first lines of the book, which are a story, which are sort of me, but a sort of every underland story. I've just got it here.
Great.
The way into the underland is through the riven trunk of an old ash tree. Late summer heat wave, heavy air, bees browsing drowsy over meadow grass, gold of standing corn, green of fresh hayrows, black of rooks on stubble fields. Somewhere down on lower ground, an unseen fire is burning its smoke a column. A child drops stones one by one into a metal bucket, ting, ting, ting. Near the ash's base, its trunk splits into a rough rift, just wide enough that a person might slip into the tree's hollow heart and there drop into the dark space that opens below. The rift's edges are smoothed to a shine by those who have gone this way before, passing through the old ash to enter the underland. And I should say that this ash, although it's figured there in a sort of mythic register, as it were, it does exist. It exists in the southwest.
I believed that it was a real place.
Okay, good. It is a real place, but also the beginning of every underland journey, as it were.
So there's this counterpart to the reality of the world beneath our feet, the worlds beneath our feet, which is also a huge part of the story that drew you to this, and that is part of the story you tell, which is that at the very same time that there's this, there's so much it's a whole frontier of what we're discovering about what is below, but that we also live in an age, as you say, of untimely surfacings, of Anthropocene unburials.
Yes. This history, or the future, we might say, overtook this book as I wrote it. That's partly because I wrote it so slowly. It took 6 or 7 years, really, to finish. But what overtook me was a sense that the underland was rising to the surface in this restless earth that we have made and are hastening the restlessness of around ourselves now. I mean, to give examples of what I mean by unburials, permafrost is no longer perma. It is melting and slushing, and as it does so, it's releasing ancient methane deposits. It's releasing the bodies of reindeer killed by anthrax, and the spores are alive and in the air again and setting off epidemics. It's releasing 50,000-year-old wolf pups in the Yukon, perfectly preserved. And structures too, an American Cold War missile base in the northwest of Greenland is rising to the surface of the ice cap. It was left because it was thought that it would always be buried by snowfall, but now snow melt is exceeding snowfall, and so it's coming to the light. And it's frightening. It's frightening.
And then there's also just the phenomenon that is very ordinary for, of spring bulbs, of flowers coming up earlier than they should, right? In so many of our places, which is another kind of resurfacing, which is has beauty and yet is eerie and feels wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. That's wonderfully put. Has beauty but is eerie. That uncanniness of seeing things out of place, but also out of time, really.
Yes.
It is an eeriness. It's not a horror, and there are horrific unburials that are happening. But these quieter ones are unsettled. There is a sense that things are unsettled. In Britain last summer, we had this drought that went on for 2 months, and one of the things that happened was that crop marks began to show on the parched fields. And these crop marks register the presence of old buried structures, which no one had been able to see, but they show up like a kind of X-ray. We're back with X-rays again on the landscape. And because people fly more drones now more easily, suddenly people started posting this footage. And they were like, that's a Roman watchtower, or that looks like a Neolithic causewayed enclosure. And these had never been seen before, but suddenly the land was disclosing these old histories.
Right, And a point you make is that that in a larger sense these phenomena also, this is the way you said it, disrupt simple notions of Earth's history as orderly. They have a power to shift our perception of something as elemental as time. Huh. You said epochs and periods are mixing and entangling.
Yes, I mean, time, spending 6-7 years thinking about the underworld has really messed up my sense of time. It's deepened it, it's tangled it. I mean, to give an example of that entanglement, which we're all part of, we're burning carboniferous fossil fuels, and in so doing, we're melting ice that was laid down in some cases in the Pleistocene, and we're in so doing we're shifting the sea levels of a future Anthropocene. And once you see it, of course, it's self-evident. But it's an odd thing. We think of time as I thought of time as orderly beneath this kind of stratified. But the other thing is that the underworld tells the future, and this I was not expecting that at all. I should have known, because Greek myth tells us, the Sibyl at Cumae, the oracle at Delphi, they foretell the future, but they do so by peering into the underworld.
Right.
And now we're doing it scientifically. We're ice coring down to possibly up to 1 million years ago now in terms of data in Antarctica, and we're using that in part to foretell our own climate futures.
Right. In a very different context these days, more the context of how people in this country and your country as well are very kind of socially and politically unsettled. I find it useful and in its way calming to invoke, you know, what Martin Luther King Jr. called the long arc of the moral universe.
Wow, what a phrase.
Which is not real time, right? What we've done with time in this particular moment is create this notion of real time, which is that something is more real because we are watching it happen, and that's just not true. And it's not the way, we live our way forward into other realities, right? And then what you bring forward, which feels to me, you know, again, it's a different context, but it's a corollary to this, is this notion of deep time, which also just sets our unrest, not necessarily in a soothing context, but in fact in a more reality-based frame of mind, right? And the way time works.
Well, I'm glad that's how it feels to you, because that's how it feels to me too. And there is a very, now to me, familiar and I think ethically intolerable move that is made around deep time, which I see more and more on a kind of climate right, as it were, which is to say, oh, it's fine. The planet's old. It has a long time ahead of it. We'll be gone. None of this really matters.
Right.
That's the deep time alibi. human time becomes subject to moral philosophy calls a flat ontology. Everything is equal in its insignificance. But that to me is derelict.
And like, why work for a different present or future?
Yeah. Right. Because it'll all pack down in the end, geologically speaking.
Right.
I meet that quite a bit, this sort of shoulder shrug. And I can't abide it. And for me, and it sounds like for you, and put in context partly by that wonderful Martin Luther King Jr. quotation, deep time is a sharpening context for me. It says, look at the gift of being now. Look at the astonishing responsibility of legacy leaving, and look at what you have inherited in the wonder of this world, and what will our time leave? That for me is the big Anthropocene question, and it's posed beautifully by Jonas Salk, the immunologist who invented more or less single-handedly the polio vaccine and has helped eradicate that disease. Are we being good ancestors?
Yes, are we being good ancestors? What a question to be asking.
It's different, isn't it, to being a parent or a grandparent? It's quite different because it's asking you to be responsible for people you not only have not met, but will never meet.
Right. Right. It's asking you to attend to the value of what you do and plant now.
Yep.
Precisely for a world you'll never see.
Yep.
I want to read just some lines of what you wrote about, you know, deep time. Now, you said, you have written that deep time was coined by John McPhee. And I always thought that was a phrase of geology. But did...
as far as I know, John McPhee does coin it in Annals of the Former World, which is his great work of geology. There are versions of it in late 18th century geology when it's emerging. James Playfair talks about the abyss of time.
Okay.
But
oh,
I think McPhee coins it, yeah.
It's more poetic. Deep time is more poetic. So you wrote, for deep time is measured in units that humble the human instant, millennia, epochs, and eons, instead of minutes, months, and years. Deep time is kept by rock, ice, stalactites, seabed sediments, and the drift of tectonic plates. Seen in deep time, things come alive that seemed inert. New responsibilities declare themselves. Ice breathes, rock has tides, mountains rise and fall. We live on a restless earth. There's another place you say that, you know, speaking of how, you know, seeing deep time as a radical perspective that provokes to responsibility and action, you said it, you know, if with this framework, this it leads us to reimagine our present. To reimagining our present, countermanding its quick greeds and furies with older, slower stories of making and unmaking. I do feel like you that kind of language feels very, first of all, it feels very, very present to the moment. And it makes it more expansive, right? It gives us space.
I'm glad you find it present. I do too. You know, when I'm looking in the hopeful places, not the other ones, of which there's an abundance. I mean, I don't know where you hear it, Krista, but I find it in the language around the sunrise movement, around Extinction Rebellion, in large part in this country, around Greta Thunberg. I work with a lot of young people in conservation contexts in this country, and they are incredible. They see things clearly. They have a strong sense of responsibility outwards in space, but also forwards in time. And this is very exciting to me to be around. Is that where you're finding these
yes,
energies?
Absolutely. And I see that same kind of energy in other spheres, in the unmaking and remaking of, so many of our forms of institutions and ways of living that came down to us don't work and are not human, humane, and Yeah, so I see corollaries to that. Again, as you say, not necessarily the most highly publicized places, kind of below the radar where people are actually living. But I do see that everywhere, yeah.
There is one image at the heart, as it were, of Underland and of the Underland, which is the hand, the opened palm, the stretched fingers, and that we know first as in a way the first mark of art, the hand stencil, as it's called, which was made in early cave art by the maker would place their hand, his or her hand, on the cave wall, and then take a mouthful of ochre, red ochre often, and then spit the dust against the hand, and then pull the hand away, and so you leave the ghost print, and and it's such an image, and for me that hand of that open hand, the hand of that is reaching across time, that is pressing against rock, but leaning also into the future, but also the hand of help and of collaboration. And I found it everywhere, actually. It astonished me. I met such kindness, such collaboration, such readiness to reach out.
Yes, that is so much a part of the story that you tell, of the hospitality that greets you everywhere.
Hospitality, that's a wonderful... Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly right.
I do want to speak also about language and the power of words and kind of the magic of words that I feel you surface in your writing and also in your investigations. I mean, even the word discover, somewhere I learned in your writing, it has this underland connotation, right? To reveal by excavation, fetch up from the depths. The book where you, I think, have focused most explicitly, I mean, this runs all the way through your writing and thinking, but the book Landmarks,
yes,
I think is just kind of devoted to that. It makes me think of how in sacred traditions, you know, naming has this power. And, you know, in Genesis, like the original creative act is next to making order out of chaos is calling things into being by giving them names.
Yes. Yes.
There's a place where you were writing about, I think, like the Isle of Lewis and sort of an Apache tribe in Arizona, and you said words act as a compass, place, speech serves literally to enchant the land, to sing it back into being and to sing one's being back into it.
Yes, well, the first thing I should say in response to that fine thought is that not all naming is good naming. Mm-hmm. There is bad naming, and naming can, as we know, be an appropriative act of conquest and overwriting.
Yes,
and the control of
well, I think that's the other side of that. Yeah. That power, right?
Is the power exactly? Mm-hmm. It is such a foundational act to give name to, and mm-hmm. with names, often they are, I sort of call them portals to love and care. We rarely care for what we cannot name. But yes, there is bad naming, but there is also, I mean, I became fascinated over 4 years in the mid-2010s, if I can call it that historically, few years back, let me say, by Lexis for landscape and the sense that we were making do, certainly in British English, increasingly with a generic portfolio of, you know, hill, field, wood, river, stream,
right.
town. And I sensed, I knew that there was this word hoard there within the wonderful diversity of languages and dialects, subdialects we have in these islands. And of course, you have your own rich word hoards through indigenous languages particularly, and regional languages. And this was particularly focused in, for me in the beginning, in Gaelic, Scots,
yes.
what we might call Scottish Gaelic, but Gaelic effectively. And so to give some examples from the moorland language of the Outer Hebrides, Runach Muim means in long form, the shadows cast on moorland by clouds on a sunny day. And and there is a drama, right, unfolded out of this two-word phrase in the mind's eye.
You've uncovered probably, I mean, hundreds, certainly, perhaps
thousands.
It's about
2,000 probably in the first edition, and then 2,500 because people began to send me, these letters would pour in from around the world, around Britain as postcards, like feathers coming.
Just reading the words themselves and the definitions of them is like, each one of them is like, it's like reading poetry. It's like reading lines. I mean, I was looking through the Landmarks book and thinking, could I? I mean, this is just, I don't want to even pronounce the words themselves because I would mispronounce them. So many of them are from Gaelic or Welsh or Cornish. But here's just one page of, this is hills, fells, and peaks. So, there's a word for a shelter used by mountaineers, typically an overhanging rock. A word, alpenglow, I can say that one.
Oh, yeah.
Light of the setting or rising sun seen illuminating high mountains or the underside of clouds. It comes from mountaineering. A hill with precipices, Gaelic. Another word, sharp ascending ridge of a mountain. There's a word in Irish, a special word for summit. There's a word for hillock in the West Country. There's a word in southern England and Wales for a conspicuous hill with long sight lines from its summit, suitable
wonderful?
For a beacon fire.
Yeah.
there's a word in Scots, it's bothy, right?
Bothy, yeah, bothy, yeah.
A hut or shelter maintained in remote country. But it just goes on and on and on.
I counted 42 words in Gaelic for different kinds of summit of mountain. So shtob. Uh-huh. A shtob in the place name would always designates quite a sharp peak, and a stack is quite sharp but has more breadth to it. And then there are terms which indicate there are corries, that's to say kind of glacially scoured hanging valleys present in the summit block, as it were. And this is all born of a tension that is a function in turn of both devotion and of labor, really, of the need to be able to describe, identify, specify, work with landscape.
Right. It's lived. It's,
yes.
It comes of living with the landscape.
Yeah. And we have, we're language making, naming species. We're always generating incredible, precise idiolects for certain aspects of our dwelling and our being and our practice. But I think it is broadly true that that these specialized lexicons have fallen away in terms of the ways we speak of landscapes and their inhabitants and their more than human worlds. And I wanted to, as it were, rewild a little the ways we, the resources we have for that kind of description.
There's that whole new world of rewilding, and I love the idea that the language has to be rewilded too. You are part of an important voice in what seems to me, it's not a new genre of writing about the natural world, but obviously, right? There's so many, Rachel Carson and John Muir, and we could name so many people who've done this. But I do feel like this is rising, surfacing. At the same time that...
That things are vanishing.
Well, no, I feel like this kind of writing and renaming is actually, I feel like this genre of writing is rising up again a bit. Do you not feel that?
Well, I do. I absolutely do. And it is almost as old as as literature.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take it back in a British context to the Celtic Christian devotional poetry that was written on remote skerries and islands in the 7th-8th century that we have fragments
of. What is that poem that kind of core poem, and it's all about images of the natural world.
Well,
is it Welsh?
There's the Mabinogion, which is the great medieval Welsh epic, which is obsessed with natural human metamorphosis. We've got Beowulf in the Old English, and Gawain and the Green Knight in the 14th century. Yeah. You're right. It is an ancient form with many sort of sustaining lines of filiation that run through to the present. But I think there is something happening now, and it has been for 10 or 15 years, and it's just no coincidence kind of polyphonic, urgent, celebratory, elegiac writing should be rising up at a time of clear ecological crisis.
Yes, and even where I just think for just about everyone on the planet, wherever they live, whether the consciousness is of ecological crisis or just that the weather is changing, which is just is the element in which we move, right? And weather, which has been the stuff of small talk.
The stuff of small talk, yes.
Yeah.
Has suddenly become, as Rebecca Solnit puts it, the mother of the mother of all questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just so intrigued with this idea also of and you know, this is manifest in the writing genre that we're talking about, of what happens when language meets landscape. Mm. And you know, it strikes me on the one hand, which I think is also true of language for God or for transcendence, sacred language, is it you're always actually trying to put words around something that ultimately defies words.
Yeah.
And I found that also, like, you know, there was a point in your book several times. I mean, there was a place when you were in the caves of Somerset and you were talking about squeezing through spaces, and you had this sentence, in that vanishing point, neither of us speaks, language is crushed. Mm. So that's, but, and yet, we can't help but try to put words to it, right? And it feels to me like, and this is so true in your writing, and also I think in this part of the human literature around natural world, more than other kinds of literature, that the attempt to meet the natural world with words leads to these extremes of lushness and whimsy and poetry, and as you say, also this incredible specificity.
Yes, well, that's right. There, it is a devotional act in many ways, but it is also bringing utterance to its brink. Because, as I write in Lammer, light has no grammar. Granite doesn't sing in words that we could speak, and so in a way, there is a wonderful falsehood at the heart of all of it, which is the notion that language is in any way mimetic here. And for some people, that's a collapse of the project. It's like, well, why bother? But for me, the artifice is part of the wonder. Clearly, we are building structures that bear no correspondence relationship with what they're describing. But they can be extraordinary, evocative, lush, sometimes bare forms of speaking. And I've noticed how important female and indigenous voices are becoming in the conversations around place and climate at the moment. Landscape doesn't speak in one voice, it speaks in many voices. And the best writers for me, Elizabeth Rush, Robin Wall Kimmerer, Bathsheba Demuth, these are writers who are putting their ear to many voices and celebrating precision, but also diversity, if that makes sense.
Yes. And I feel like the word diversity isn't really big enough, right? I mean, it's multitudinousness, if that's a word.
Exactly. It is biodiversity in the fullest sense of bios, of life. Multitudinous is a glorious term for it, I think. Itself a kind of plenished term.
Yes. There's, you know, what also strikes me about, especially when you're writing where you just lay out, you know, these pages and pages of words and glossaries, there's also, as you say, not always, sometimes what is being described as grave or perilous, but there's also just this playfulness that runs all the way through it, right? You know?
Which, I'm glad you hear that. I sometimes think I don't make enough jokes, but I'm glad you hear that.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to me that it matches what it's describing, right? Because that is also, I don't know, trees beg to be climbed, right?
they beg to be climbed. I could read you a moment of surfacing, if you want, just a few sentences. Because those moments of surfacing where the soul is drinking so deeply of the upper world again, having been down. Let me see if I can find this. So we're just coming out of this underworld in the Mendips, this limestone system we've just been in. I feel the snap of the black stone's jaws at the empty air below my toes, and then I am out of the swallet and into the hollow, and warm air is rolling around me, and my bones grow again in the storm of light, and ferns furl their green over and into me, and moss thrives on my skin, and leaves teem in my eyes. And Sean and I sit laughing, knowing for those few moments that to understand light, you need first to have been buried in the deep down dark.
Yeah,
and
wonderful.
that we were laughing.
Yeah,
for wonder, for sheer wonder and relief.
I feel also that this adventure you've been on is also full of the realities and discoveries that things that we're only now learning to see.
Mm-hmm.
In order to put words around, it feels to me like one of those things. I don't know if this is new to you, but it was new to me. And just the way you describe about the connection between ice and the nature of ice and memory, that ice has a memory and the color of this memory is blue. Ice remembers in detail and it remembers for a million years or more. Ice remembers forest fires and rising seas. Ice remembers the chemical composition of the air around the start of the last ice age. Was that a discovery to you?
I am a cryophile. I love ice with all my warm-blooded heart, and and I always have done. And so it wasn't a surprise to me, but delving into the science of that memory, if we can call it that, was a revelation. And I remember standing in a cold store. I'm in Cambridge, that's where I teach, and just nearby we have the British Antarctic Survey, which is the heart of polar science, really, in Britain. And I went into this cold store with Robert Mulvaney, a climate scientist, glaciologist, and he took out a section of core that had come up from deep down in the ice cap, the Antarctic ice cap. And then he took out a slice of it and held it up. And it's like looking into a planetarium or a night sky. It sparkles, this stuff. And the sparkles are bubbles. And the bubbles are air that was trapped when this ice fell as snow and softly, softly caught air in its layers. And as the ice gets buried, so the air gets compressed into these bubbles, and the bubbles are memory. They remember what the atmosphere was like, what it contained at that time. And I love this thought of ice as having a memory. And we're learning now to read that memory, to recover that memory, even as the memory itself is being lost through melt.
Mm. Another thing that I learned through reading you is that even in the last couple of years, there's been this revelation of what you called a deep life's ecosystem in the Earth's crust that is twice the volume of the world's oceans, containing a biodiversity comparable to that of the Amazon.
Yeah, what about that, eh? I mean, it's just this all came out after a 5-year research project disclosed its findings in, I think, about 9 months ago. And so, guys, there's an entire ecosystem down there which dramatically exceeds in biomass the entire human population of the Earth at present. Is incredibly diverse, And it goes 7 miles down and probably more. I mean, what about that for a declaration of how little we know?
Yes. You know, most of the podcasts I listen to are from BBC Radio 4. and I listen to a number of science podcasts because, you know, like, why was that what you just told me, what was revealed in 2018? Why was this not on the front page of the New York Times, right?
I know.
This is news, right? This is news.
Huge news. Huge news. That and we stand on ignorance.
Yes.
And it is good to be... to be reminded of that, and that's not a failing, that's a humility and an incentive, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my worry always when we discover a new horizon of life is, of course, that we will turn our extractive and annihilatory attention towards it.
Yes.
That's you know, deep sea mining currently is a new mm-hmm. extractive horizon, partly driven by the need for certain elements and resources to help the transition to renewable energy. It's or at least that is how industry is representing it.
Yeah, and another whole new, it's like a whole new planet in our midst is what you, I don't, this language of the world wide wood.
the wood wide web.
Wood wide web.
Wood Wide Web, yeah.
Wood Wide Web.
The Wood Wide Web, yeah.
Okay.
Would that were my phrase, but it is not. Yeah. Did you, was that fresh to you, this revelation of the Wood Wide Web?
No. I mean, I don't know if I'd heard that phrase before or not. I mean, I think I first really took in that phrase. I have been aware of this. It's like kind of what we're learning about trees and and forests and things like fungi and and mosses, which were things we've thought of as parasites, it turns out are essential to vitality and
collaboration,
the mutuality of
glorious mutualism, which is about 450 million years old, we think, because a fossil lithograph effectively exists from around then, showing it in action, whereby certain fungi, ecto and endomycorrhizal fungi, plug into the roots of trees and plants at a cellular level and create an interface across which resources and messages to some degree can be carried. And then those fungi plug into the roots of other trees. And so the trees can, as Suzanne Simard, the pioneering forest ecologist who helped break open this ground, writes, can talk to one another. And this, you know, once you've met this idea, wow, it shakes the ground you walk on. A park is a wondrous place, but it also challenges our ideas of what an individual is, what an organism is, where being begins and ends. It does not end at the body horizon. We know that increasingly and in complex and often political ways.
Mm. There was you were describing a conversation in Underland with Martin Sheldrake in Epping Forest.
Yeah, Merlin, the wonderfully named Merlin Sheldrake.
Merlin. And you quoted him. It was just fantastic. I was saying, my early superheroes weren't Marvel characters, but lichen and fungi, and that they annihilate, that lichen and fungi annihilate our categories of gender. They reshape our ideas of community and cooperation. They screw up our hereditary model of evolutionary descent. They utterly liquidate our notions of time.
What's more superhero than that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, listen out for the name of Merlin Sheldrake, because he is writing, just finishing a book on fungi and their superheroism and the ways they stitch our world into relation. In astonishing and hugely consequential, but largely invisible ways. So yeah, Merlin was one of these many people who conjured open the Underland for me and kind of helped me see into it. I needed that. But, you know, many travelers into the underworld in myth and story have historically been accompanied by a guide. Sometimes those guides are unreliable. But you need someone in classical Greek. That's called the psychopomp, the accompanist. But Merlin was one of those many who helped me see in the dark.
I think that you're also making, kind of circling back around where we where we have circled around in this conversation. And let me say this: we were speaking a minute ago about places we find hope and kind of new imagination,
yes,
for new realities forming. And I do experience, and you know, every good word gets overused in human cultures, right? So I feel like now the word ecosystem is being overused, but it's a total, it's a tectonic shift, really, in like thinking about how institutions work and leadership works and how things happen, how movements work, how forms are changed, how minds are changed, how we work together to create new realities. It does feel to me like these kinds of discoveries about how reality works, how life works, are not only relevant to how we're reimagining, I think somewhere you said historical narratives of progress, but also remaking how we structure our life together.
I hope so, Krista. I really hope so. At the core of them is something a bit more complex than just connection. It's entanglement.
Yeah.
And for me, entanglement is different to connection because connection is purely a structural effect. But entanglement is as it were, requires a mutualism to be recognized, that there are consequences within of entanglement, that if one thing is destroyed or leaned too heavily on or exhausted, then this will... This will recoil, as it were, and we have too long thought of ourselves as an arrogant species that can draw on the world as inexhaustible standing resource, whether that be to provide or to accept that which we dispose of, and that relies on a very monadic notion of being. And these revelations of entanglement are they destroy those ideas, and they show us to be profoundly porous and to be nothing but holes almost and string.
I was a couple of years ago in a conversation with a group of people who were all in their 20s, early 30s, and they this language, I think the topic was supposed to be scaling, which is such a 20th century hierarchical, right? Like survival of the fittest, the way we've thought, which isn't true to how the world works.
Yeah.
And I think they came up with this language of communal flourishing. But as you say, it was very complex, right? It wasn't just about being connected. Sometimes the way I think about it sometimes is, can we get our vulnerability and our flourishing connected, but this was also acknowledging the reality that in communal flourishing, some things will live and some things will die. Some things will get bigger, some things will get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that there could be kind of a web of mutuality in which all of that was held.
Well, I think Donna Haraway, whose work you will know, she talks about making kin. And another lovely word she has is sympoiesis. So poiesis has that sense of creation, of creating, but sim gives us that creating with. So the idea of making kin and of sympoiesis, and for Haraway, working with Lynn Margulis, the sort of founder of epigenetics, if you like, this is happening at a genetic level, an epigenetic level, as well as at a kind of creative and communal and societal level. So it kind of has form as a way of proceeding, if you like. Life has always literally flourished and grown through co-making.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, this is a turn. Minecraft. I was so surprised, and this just reveals the limits of my knowledge, that you wrote a piece about Minecraft, and you started it by saying, the imaginary landscape in which I spend most time is born not of a book or a film, but of an algorithm. And I guess you spend time in Minecraft with one of your children or with your children?
Yeah, when I wrote that short piece about Minecraft, I was spending a great deal of time in that underworld. And it was also the time when I was, when I was in physical underlands a great deal. And I became fascinated by it as this virtual realm. Of course, people have written about how it is a sort of parable of extractive human progress. You know, you've got to get down there and mine your resources and build and build and build. But it also has this realm, this mythic realm called the Nether. And the Nether is what you pass into through a portal that you construct out of obsidian. And the Nether is all our underlands rolled into one. And so I found myself, sometimes I would come back from these trips into nuclear waste storage facilities or cave systems, and then I would be sitting down with my kids and they'd be like, "Let's go to the Nether, Dad." I've just come back from there.
So does this phenomenon of Minecraft, I mean, there are echoes for you or possibilities in this experience for the kinds of things we've been talking about to be explored in new ways or named in new ways?
Yeah, I mean, Minecraft in its pure form, as mm-hmm. I'm sure you play it a great deal. Non-stop. But you know that I think that the pure form of Minecraft is so-called the creative mode, and it is sort of without limits, as it were. It's a sandbox game where you create your own forms and visions, and I've loved watching my children build these utopias, really, these dream worlds out of the resources that they find. So I think there is a conceptual beauty to it, but of course, you know, each person builds the structure they dream of, and those dreams are not always good ones.
Mm. One of the things you say about landscape, a deep truth about landscape, which is also a deep truth about humanity, is that when we look at a landscape, we do not see what is there, but largely what we think is there. That what is savage or bleak or beautiful is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Well, I mean, in a way, this is a truism, but I think it's worth re-encountering, because we naturalize so many views of landscape, but of course they're all, in a sense, constructed. Blake says, "Oh, the tree that moves some people to tears is
for, hello,
hello." Hello?
Oh, no.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. You're back.
Roger.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Krista?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Are we back?
No, you also went away and then resurfaced.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Shall I pick up again? Just with them?
Yeah.
With Blake?
Yes. Do you remember where we were?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll start. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in some sense, that's, I guess, a truism, but it's worth looking at again, because we naturalize so many views of landscape. I guess it's good to unsettle them a little bit. Blake says that the tree that moves some people to tears of joy is for another just a green thing that stands in the way.
All right.
But I think mountains really, you know, they're the best example of this. 300-400 years ago, they're undesirable, as we've said, and then an aesthetic and cultural revolution occurs, and suddenly they become fetish objects that people are literally dying to climb. And this is amazing. So our landscapes are formed of strata of memory and association, as well as soil and rock.
So there's a There's a moment in where you say, in writing Underland, I filled dozens of notebooks, some of which were destroyed or rendered illegible by the environments in which I carried them, and that just somehow felt just right to me.
Good. Yeah, that's the shadow archive of Underland. I mean, it came out at 500 pages or whatever, but there were another 300 pages when I finished the first draft, and then there's this sort of smelly, scruffy, foxed box of notebooks, some of which are, yeah, the water just got to them and they became these Rorschach prints.
So you've also said that what started as a journey into pure matter became, to your surprise, an exploration of hidden human depths, both wondrous and atrocious. Mm-hmm. We all carry underlands within us, but only rarely acknowledge their existence. And it does seem to me that so much in the landscapes you explore, and also the science you explore around it, the discoveries we're making, speak to and illuminate the depths of human experience.
It's lovely to hear you say that. They illuminate only a few parts of them, of course, and only the corners I can see when I raise the taper to my eyes. But I guess when I'm alluding to that sense of the underlands we carry with us, that for me is trauma. It's lost memories or buried memories in some sense. So that's, as it were, the dark matter in a moral...
Right, the dark matter in us.
In us.
Where the light does not intersect.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And either we can't bring those things to the light or we choose not to. And I did... And there's a chapter in the middle of Underland which takes place up in the Slovenian... Italian limestone borderlands, which was the darkest place I'd ever been. That's about some of the reprisal killings that were carried out, really using the landscape as a means of execution and a means of disposal in the closing years of the Second World War. And the sinkholes in the cast limestone landscape there became a place where people were taken to and pushed into, either alive or wounded or dead, and bodies and bones are still being recovered from these places. It's an extremely disputed, complex, highly politicized history that is still itself unburying again and again. It's an unclosed wound in that part of Europe, and that was a terrible place to come to terms with, and that's really where the heart of the horror is. And then oddly, you know, hope was found in a nuclear waste storage facility where people were trying to do the best they could.
In Finland,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
There was a moment when you were in... Okay, so is DRIFT is the acronym, right?
DRIFT, yes.
Then, and what, sorry, what does that stand for? Just say a little bit about what DRIFT is.
DRIFT has two meanings in the underworld. Mm-hmm. In mining, DRIFT is the tunnel networks that mines spread out. So as they excavate their resource, they create a tunnel system, and that's known as DRIFT. Mm-hmm. And partly because of that, in this dark matter research laboratory in this case in Yorkshire, in the northeast of England, though there are other dark matter laboratories across the world, including one in a disused gold mine in one of the Dakotas.
Yes.
Dark matter is studied, and dark matter is, as you know, is the missing mass at the heart of the universe. We experimentally know that it exists because it has effects that suggests that it makes up around 27% of the universe's mass. But beyond that, despite billions of dollars of scientific budget, we know almost nothing else about it.
Yeah.
And I find that thrilling, this void, this huge underland at the heart of our knowledge.
And that these laboratories are being built underground where there is no light. To try to figure out what this
what
is,
dark matter is,
to replicate the darkness.
Well, I mean, that yes, it, I should say, of course, it's
a in a sense of
well, it's a figurative darkness. So they, of course, they do have light, though not necessarily within the experimental chambers themselves. Mm. But the point of being underground is that the rock above these laboratories around them seals them from the atomic noise of the above ground universe. So it sort of excludes a lot of experimental interference that would come in the form of conventional atomic presence. So it's an attempt, as the scientists put it, to find the quietest place in the universe where they can listen out for the whisper of dark matter.
It's so interesting. So there's a moment where you're having this conversation with this very intriguing young physicist named Christopher Toth. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you ask him, why are you searching for dark matter? And he says, and I think you say without hesitation, to further our knowledge and to give life meaning. If we're not exploring, we're not doing anything, we're just waiting. And then you said to him, is it an act of faith?
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's partly because we were close to Revo Abbey, which is one of the great Cistercian abbeys of my country. And I'd driven past it earlier that day, and I just suddenly realized that the monks sending their prayers up to an unseen God had such strong echoes for me with these scientists in their extraordinarily constructed, in this case, sort of crypts cut into 270 million year old rock salt, a mile underground almost. And they too were scrutinizing the universe for messages from an unseen, unknown presence. beautifully faithful, both across 700 years.
There's some words also. You said there's something seemingly paradoxical that darkness might be a medium. You were really speaking more about not specifically about this dark matter laboratory, but that since before we were Homo sapiens, humans have been seeking out spaces of darkness in which to find and make meaning, and that there's something seemingly paradoxical in that darkness might be a medium of vision and that descent may be a movement towards revelation. And it feels to me like that for you personally, there was something in that.
Well, I definitely was more changed and learnt more about myself and I think about the world more broadly speaking, if I can call it that, from the years of this book than any other. And that may have something to do with, being 43, 37 when I began it, 36. And, death's been around as it has for everybody. And so maybe the shadows are deepening a little bit in that sense. But I when you were reading those words, I was remembering being in the Cave of the Red Dancers, which is this sea cave in Arctic Norway, hard by a huge whirlpool that is known as the Maelstrom, which gives us that word that is now a generic for whirlpools. And so there are two entries, one into the mountain and one into the sea, right by each other. And in what we might call the Bronze Age, 2 to 3,000 years ago, people traveled to that hard, hard place, and they made art in the darkness, red dancing figures that leaped on the walls of that sea cave. And they crossed two thresholds. They crossed the threshold of entering the cave, and then they crossed the second one, which is in a way the more powerful one, which is where light gives way to darkness. And it was once they'd crossed that second threshold that they began to paint. And that to me, I mean, I wept. I wept when I saw those figures. Partly because it had been such a hard winter journey to get to them, but also time shifted in ways I've never really experienced before in that space.
You say actively to retrieve something from the underland almost always requires effortful work, and I feel like that speaks both to this the physical effort that you describe, but also this. this move that we make as human beings, always reluctantly, to go down, to go under, to go in, to go into the dark, and yet again and again find something essential there.
Yes, that toil, I think, is there throughout this book. Nothing comes easily in the Underland. Few things are easily put there, and it's even harder to bring them to the surface effort deliberately, as it were. Though something
deliberately, right?
And yeah, some things rise unbidden,
because of
unexpectedly. But and I, you know, it did take me literally years just to do the writing. I mean, it just it felt like a. Sometimes I watch archaeologists because I just love specialists. I love hanging out with lichenologists and archaeologists. And if you're a specialist, don't come near me unless you want lots of questions. But when you see an archaeologist uncovering a bone, it's such tender care. It's work, but they're using brushes and air guns and slowly revealing, excavating, discovering this buried presence, and the writing felt a little bit like that as well. So much to be brushed away first.
You're now, I understand, doing some work in hospitals in the UK to bring nature into the lives. Tell me about that.
Oh, I'm glad that's crossed your path. Yes, this arises from a book called The Lost Words that I made with Jackie Morris, which has been the wildest thing I've ever been involved with, in the sense that you plant an acorn and a wildwood springs up around it. The book has become so many things, and among the things it's become, as well as being placed by community efforts into pretty much every primary school in the British Isles now, it's been taken into hospitals. It's been used in hospices. It's been used in dementia care. It was written primarily for children, but of course they're not the only ones who lack language.
It's these words, right? It's what we were talking about language and lost words, and with illustration.
Yes, sorry, I should. Yes. So these were 20. The simplest form of the book is just 20 words that fell out of a widely used children's dictionary because they weren't being used enough, and they were words for nature. Acorn, bluebell, kingfisher, conker, wren, willow, and so we just wanted to make a spell book that might conjure them back. But and we did. Jackie's an artist. I've written these spell poems, and they've gone into hospitals. So hospitals have taken the art and taken the spells and have designed them floor to ceiling across four stories, for example, of a new orthopedic rehabilitation hospital in North London, and also in a critical care unit in Wales. And they're actually becoming part of the healing work that's done. So where young children who are recovering from orthopedic difficulties, they walk the corridors doing their physio. And so Jackie would put a tiny mouse in each panel of the murals, and the children would move a little further each time to find the mouse hidden among the buttercups and the and the moths. And then there would be places where patients and relatives could stop and read the spells from floor to ceiling. And it's hearing the reports come back from hospices, terminal care contexts, where people, I mean, it's about nature much more than the book. The book is just a catalyst for that. But nature's power, I remember hearing a patient who was very close to death, it turned out, just speaking about trees. And he reached out, he was taken outside in the final days of his life, and he reached out both hands and he gripped the trunk of a silver birch. And he just spoke about what he felt pulsing through that tree and into him through the bark, and that was an extraordinary moment for him, and to be reminded of that consolation, that the force that through the green fuse drives the flower, as Dylan Thomas puts it, was a wonder, a humbling wonder.
It makes me think of work that's being done studying, you know, in hospitals also, that if people have a window and can see a tree outside the window, their healing is accelerated. that their outcomes are bit right. And also something, you know, I cannot remember where I heard this, but I've thought about it so much since, that almost this is this idea. I don't know if this is true, but that almost every person, if you ask them about the happiest memories of their childhood, that it will feature the natural world.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Whenever I meet a young person who, or indeed an older person who loves nature, I always say to them, "How did this begin? What triggered it?" And I was in Wales this weekend trying to help young people begin a big, large-scale landscape regeneration project there. And I asked a young woman from, a 17-year-old from East London. And she said, my father grew up in Nigeria and he had a garden there. He grew things. Then we came here and now he grows things. And he talks to his plants and he sings to them and he tells me their names and he speaks to them as other beings. And then he took me to the river, this kind of grotty East London river, and we cleaned it up, and we got our gloves on and our waders on, and we took stuff out of it, and it made the river better. And I just thought that story of two things, of singing and speaking to the natural world as though it were alive, which it is,
yeah.
And then cleaning up a river, just so simply, cleaning up a river. I was incredibly moved, so I gave her two acorns from the land, and I said, "Take these to your dad, and give them to him from me."
I'm curious about the language of spell book and spell songs. There's an album that goes along with the book, which I just started listening to last night, and it's so beautiful.
Oh, I'm so glad you think so.
Oh, it's so beautiful. So, tell me about that. First of all, that language of spells, where does that emerge from?
Well, I could read you a quick one. That's probably the best way to instantiate it. I did bring it. I mean, spells are there to be spoken. That's they have an oral power. They're utterances. And I've always loved reading aloud and writing to read aloud, as it were. And So in that sense, I wanted to write a language that tumbled on the tongue and turned around. And this is Wren. I'm sure your listeners know that the Wren is this tiny, quick-moving bird. We hardly see them in this country, though. There are 8 million breeding pairs of them because they move so fast. They seem to teleport. So here goes Wren. When Wren whirs from stone to furze, the world around her slows. For Wren is quick, so quick she blurs the air through which she flows. Yes, rapid Wren is needle, rapid Wren is pin, and Wren's song is sharp song, briar song, thorn song, and Wren's flight is dart flight, flick flight, light flight. Yes, each Wren etches, stitches, switches, glitches. Yes, now you think you see Wren, now you know you don't.
Did you commission the music alongside the writing of the book?
No, the music followed it as much music has of many kinds, but spell songs is this cornucopia of folk and other kinds of music adapting the spells and the art of the book. And it just arose because people had read the book and came and said, we want to make an album of this. And so they brought together these incredible singers from around languages and parts of the British Isles, a lot of Scots and Gaelic singers. I just said, look, do whatever you want. Just, you don't need to sort of set my words slavishly. Just let it come to life in your brilliance, however it does. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you've got it. Have a listen to The Blessing, which is the final song.
Oh, I did. I listened to that last night. Yeah, it's wonderful. And I can't wait to listen. Just have it kind of as a soundtrack.
Oh, that's great. I'll tell them that you're listening. They'll be happy.
Yeah. I feel like we've been speaking about this the entire time, but I'm curious about how this adventure, this investigation, and just these things you've been thinking about these years. This is a ridiculously large question. So just how you would begin to reflect on it, you know, how this has changed the way you think about like life and death and what it means to be human, how you move through the world, how you parent differently.
Well, In a way, I can't remember what it was like before beginning this river run, because each book flows really into the next and out of the last, as it were. Mm. So it started 20 years ago, and I don't have much memory from before that. But
yeah.
I guess, I am, as you said at the beginning, landscape and the human heart, this is to me an inexhaustible and eventually unmappable terrain. And of course, the heart is a many-chambered thing, and some of those chambers hold hate, and landscape activates some of those hateful chambers too. We see that in the rise of ethno-nationalism, or we see that in the idea that a piece of land can be taken or broken. But it also activates love and grace and joy. Raymond Carver, great American short story writer, who once described himself as a cigarette with a body attached to it, and did die of his cancer. He moved in his late life after a hard and problematic and alcoholic life to the Pacific Northwest, and he wrote with extraordinary simplicity about what being by running water and among healthy forests meant to him there. Those late poems of Carver's, A New Path to the Waterfall. These are lucid documents of healing.
Hmm. What about your children? How you speak to them? What feels important to show them, to share with them, and even to learn from them? How do you think?
Oh, learning from them all the time.
Yeah, what you do flow, you know, shapes that.
Well, we're off to the Extinction Rebellion events that are going to take over London in the next week. I'm going to be reading as part of the Writers Rebel event, and the children are going to come along to that. I've walked with my daughter on the climate strikes, but where she's the leader, you know, she's the one. She's very active in climate politics. But I think most when you ask me that question about my 6-year-old, who features as a 4-year-old quite a lot in Underland, and I took him up to these spring sites near our house, where the book ends, the book surfaces. But we went back not so long ago. But there should be a place of life where water rises from, wells up from within the ground. But they were dead. There was nothing. There was no life. They'd shrunk to a puddle and a mud bath. And this is because of over abstraction, you know, water that we use in our household, but also an Anthropocene drought, really, that's gripping the southeast of England in the longer term. And he was, he doesn't really understand any of that stuff, obviously, but it's just struck his soul to see a spring site dry. And he came back so forceful, so clear about what needed to be done. And he has been on our case about water, about water use ever since. And so it was such a fascinating moment for me to watch this encounter with an absence translate itself into a sort of the politics of a 6-year-old, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And translate an absence into an action, right? Into a forward movement.
Yes.
I think that something that's on my mind these days, and I don't know if this is a reaction people are having, is, you know, the strike and the rebellion and how to accompany that into this other word you've been using, which is the healing, right? The stitching, the stitching back together we have to do, or stitching anew. How are you observing? Are you observing that question, or?
Well, I mean, I speak to you from amid a political turmoil here that is unprecedented in my lifetime, and that has reached a pitch of bitterness and ugliness in the last 2 days, particularly following the prorogation that was deemed unlawful
I listen to the Today Show every morning.
Right. Okay. Well, you know,
I started doing as a way to get beyond American politics,
no.
And now I have like two political tragedies unfolding at the same time.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, yeah. One tar pit is carelessness, but
yeah.
Well, that's the tar pit we're in right now. Mm-hmm. But there is a new energy. Of hope in the air. Coming back to our underlying metaphors, it's what Rebecca Solnit calls hope in the dark.
Yeah.
And she points out that, you know, Greta Thunberg sits outside of a school lonely and nothing should have happened from that. But look what has happened. She points out that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is so inspired by the Standing Rock protests that she decides to run as a congresswoman. And these unlikely cascades of consequence are what keep me going. That and the acorns, and I do see hope in the Green New Deal politics that is spreading fast across, particularly the global north. And there are huge problems already baked into it. We can see those, but they are being seen, and the best of efforts are being made to address them. And I think two other things as well. I think that environmental justice is finally swung into line with social justice, that these have been seen absolutely as continuous with one another. And secondly, that a hopeful future is being seen, one where cities are not choked by pollution that is killing the poorest, because decarbonization is underway, that instead of a green future being seen as a rabbit skin future of regression, it's a progressive one. These are the things that keep me going in the mornings when I turn on the Today program. How about you?
Okay, well, we'll stop there because is there anything else you want to, anything else you, that just feels like you'd like to say out of this large meandering conversation we just had? It's been fantastic.
It's been a joy of a conversation. I feel that we have created a subtext here that we have, or a word wide web that we have moved between unlikely points and joined them together, and that seems like the best of structures.
Such
really.
A joy to have known you through your writing and to actually be in conversation. I think one of my producers has a question for me behind the glass, so I'm going to listen for a minute. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in terms of this notion of all this learning about the landscape and I think human wholeness and the spiritual nature of that as expansively as you want to describe spiritual, are there ways you would talk about even just kind of helping other people, or maybe even, I don't know, I feel like you do this probably organically with your family, integrate that, experience that. Kind of know that more organically in their own lives. How to step into that actively?
How to step into that? Well, I think it's a wonderful question, and I devote a lot of my life outside my writing life to that. I do have a perhaps naive faith in the power of the natural world and of, as it were, the green world to speak straight to the spirit, and of course there are historical textures and anomalies that neutralize that possibility in certain people in certain places. But so I believe strongly in getting people out. So I co-founded a charity 5 years ago, and we take kids out of inner city schools and we take them on free summer camps to, you know, places they would never otherwise see. And just watching what happens, watching them grow in a few short days, is the hard proof of that concept for me. So I think, you know, be out, get out, look up, walk where and when you can, and be curious and be astonished by the world. Live in what John Muir called a storm of wonder for a few minutes or a few hours each week.
Wonderful. I wanted to ask you, there was a dark matter physicist and poet who you mentioned in Underland, and I could never find that reference again. Or am I imagining it?
No,
I didn't know the name.
No, she's actually passed away now. Young, far too young. But I could read you the if I can find it, the phrases that feature here. Let me see if I can find her. Yeah, so perhaps I'll just read you the paragraph that features her. It's just four sentences.
Yeah.
Dark matter physics requiring patience and something like faith. As if, in the analogy of the poet and dark matter physicist Rebecca Elson, all there were fireflies, and from them you could infer the meadow.
That's it. Well, Robert, thank you so much. I hope our paths might... Yes.
No problem.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Yeah, yep. No, thank you. Thank you for letting us know.
Are you good, Roger? Okay. Well, I'll just read you the paragraph that features Rebecca's work. Dark matter physicists work at the boundary of the measurable and the imaginable. They seek the traces that dark matter leaves in the perceptible world. Theirs is a hard philosophical work, requiring patience and something like faith. As if, in the analogy of the poet and dark matter physicist Rebecca Elson, all there were fireflies, and from them you could infer the meadow.
I know. Yeah. Hello?
Hi.
So I think it was recorded, but...
The paragraph has
got
been
cut
recorded.
Okay. Thank you so much. I actually hope that our paths might cross in person one day. I have a love of Scotland and in particular the island of Islay. And I will be exploring more up there. So... I just blessings to you, and thank you for your work so much.
Thank you. This means a great deal to hear that from you. And Cambridge isn't going anywhere, and neither am I. So
okay, if I ever get to Cambridge, I'll let you know.
You come here, and if you ever want any travel advice about the Highlands, or then let me know, Krista. So.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, go well, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.